Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Nick Augustine here with attorney Joseph Roble from Joseph Roble Limited, the Chicago bankruptcy law firm. This is the Chicago Bankruptcy Update, featuring information, news, and updates in bankruptcy law. Financial troubles are stressful, and bankruptcy can be a solution for you. If you are considering filing a bankruptcy, Joseph Roble will courteously and professionally review your finances, answer all your questions, and provide the information you need to allow you to decide if bankruptcy makes sense, has value, and is the best way to provide relief from your financial woes. For a library of information about bankruptcy and the Chicago bankruptcy firm of Joseph Roble Limited, please visit the website at chicagobankruptcy.com. Again, that's chicagobankruptcy.com. Today's Chicago Bankruptcy Questions and Answers with Joseph Roble, our December 2015 edition, covers a few of the following questions that are real questions that we have sourced from various people and locations. Of course, it's all anonymous. Anyone who does have a question at any time and wants to have it read on our show can certainly send an email to Joseph Roble at josephroble@chicagobankruptcy.com. All right, our questions for today, here are just a sampling. First, we'll talk about, can I file for a Chapter 7 even after I was served for a foreclosure complaint on the home? Another one, what is the pre-bankruptcy course, and when and why do I need to take it and complete it? Another question, are there limits to interest and fees and charges I have to pay on a credit card, and if I do that debt in the Chapter 13? Another question, how does reaffirmation work with loans for homes and vehicles when we want to keep them? And another one, how will I be affected by my spouse's bankruptcy filing, and does that mean that I also need to file with them? Again, these are real questions from real people covering the gamut of types of situations and scenarios that occur, and what we do in this program is try to ask and answer those questions to the best of Joe Roble's attorney powers, which usually means more information might be needed, but a general overview of how everything works is what we do on this program. Again, I'm here with Joseph Roble, and he's been a practicing attorney since 1973 and has experience in a wide variety of legal matters relating to individuals and families. He presently concentrates his practice in consumer bankruptcy, and Mr. Roble has helped clients get out of debt and get a fresh financial start for many years. He's an active member in several bar associations and is on the bankruptcy panel of the pro bono program at the Chicago Volunteer Legal Services. Mr. Roble earned his BA in psychology from Northwestern University, and in 1973, he earned his Juris Doctorate from DePaul University Law School, also in Chicago. He also served in the U.S. Army Reserve 363rd Civil Affairs Unit. As we get going, as a general disclaimer, this is a general information program, and the advice shared on this show does not necessarily constitute legal advice. Communication with attorney guests among guests and callers on our show cannot give rise to attorney-client relationships, and if you have specific questions, you should call the bankruptcy law firm of Joseph Roble Limited and make an appointment to speak to an attorney by dialing area code 312-781-0996. The telephone number again is 312-781-0996. All right, as we get moving, Joe, how are your holidays going? I know everybody's been so busy, and now that we're coming out towards the end of the year, most people experience that the money is spent phenomenon.
Well, the holidays have gone fine. The time of year is such that, yes, starting in January, those bills come due. And hopefully people will have them under control. We're here to help out people who have not been able to control their financial situation. I'm a little under the weather with a cold, so if you want to hear me coughing during this half hour, my apologies in advance, but otherwise ready to go here, even though it's sleeting like crazy in Chicago.
Oh, well, I'm in Texas, and we had a blizzard in the panhandle, 80 degrees the other day, and, of course, tornadoes going through. So as long as the four walls are around me, I'm in a good spot. So
I feel the same way. I feel the same way.
Right. All right. So, all right. So moving forward, our first question is from an individual who has a roommate. The roommate was sued for past due medical bills. So the roommate's on Social Security disability insurance. First, can they seize a bank account? And secondly, can they take possession of the roommate's vehicles that are free and clear titled?
Okay, so this is a situation where the prospective debtor, oh, let's call him the roommate, being on SS, Social Security disability, there are no wages to garnish. They can't. A creditor can't touch Social Security. A creditor can, if they file a lawsuit and then obtain a judgment in court, freeze the roommate's bank account. Now, if the funds in the bank account are strictly Social Security and they're not mingled with anything else, they can be released. It becomes sort of a pain in the you-know-what when that happens. That's not much of a problem, the bank accounts, but owning vehicles that are paid for could be a problem. It depends on where, what state the roommate lives in, and it depends on the value of the vehicles. A relatively new vehicle could be subject to being seized and sold to satisfy a judgment. An old vehicle will probably be exempt. Exempt means you are allowed to keep certain things that you own, real estate, bank accounts, vehicles, etc. When you're sued or if you file a bankruptcy, depending on the value, and that varies from state to state, client to client. And I have no idea where this particular person lives. So if bankruptcy is something they're thinking about to eliminate the medical bills and never have to worry about them, not deal with a seizure of bank accounts, and not to have a car taken and sold to satisfy the judgment, as I say many, many times on the program, contact a local experienced bankruptcy attorney and get some advice. The attorney will know the exemptions for the state in which they live and whether the vehicle would be exempt under a bankruptcy or even under a seizure for a judgment.
All right. Well, good luck to the friend or the roommate, or if the person with the question actually is the one with the question, I'd say, again, what Joe says, and go call your local bankruptcy attorney. Get the facts. All right, our next question is someone lives in the state of South Carolina and they have no health insurance. This is something that's common to a lot of folks these days. The person says that they have accumulated about $30,000 in medical bills and ran off to go get married and does not want to leave the future wife with debt if this guy passes away before he pays it off. Any thoughts on what he should do with his $30,000 in medical bills and no health insurance in the state of South Carolina?
Okay, so this is a very common question that comes up periodically on our program. It comes up often with new client interviews. The wife-to-be cannot possibly ever be responsible for any debt that her husband-to-be has incurred before they married. So that's never an issue. The only possible way that could have happened or could happen would be if she signed with him before marriage, making herself jointly responsible on a credit card or went to the hospital with him and guaranteed payment. Other than that, there's no effect on her whatsoever. After they get married, additional bills, in general, if they're just in, let's say, the husband's name, she's not going to be responsible unless she signed a joint credit card, a joint loan, made herself a guarantor on a medical bill. Except for something called, in the state of Illinois, the Family Expense Statute. The statute in the state of Illinois, and a very similar one in many, many states, says that a spouse can be responsible for debts relating to the family, even though not in his or her name. In Illinois, I have not seen this come up in 20 years in any kind of a situation. It's a very difficult thing to prove in our state, and it may be the same in many, many other states. Once again, if someone finds themselves in such a situation where they're being threatened by a lawsuit or the possibility of a lawsuit by a creditor and the debt's not theirs, it's the spouse's debt, contact a local attorney who knows the law in the state in which you live to get a good answer.
Mm-hmm. I have another question to add on to that. What if, when we talk about commingling often, it usually comes up in terms of assets. Well, what about debts? Let's say the person has credit card debts and a bunch of other debts, including these educational loans from prior to the marriage, for example, or medical bills from prior to the marriage. What if you take all those debts and do a consolidation where things that are joint debts between the husband and wife are also commingled with those other debts from prior to the marriage? Does that change anything?
No. Again, you can only, other than that family expense issue, which is something that I raise, and as a lawyer, you have to tell people of possibilities, even though very unlikely. But other than that issue, you're only going to be responsible for what you signed for. The marriage isn't going to make you an accessory to your spouse's debt without you actively signing for it.
All right.
Does that answer it?
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense. Again, something that I think people think in terms of family law, the family law statutes, again, are different from bankruptcy. So what, you know, there's a different issues there. So
let me extend that a little further. Something similar to this question is people ask me, okay, if I die, I don't want my spouse or my family to be responsible. Well, it's the same issue. If you're deceased, the creditor can't go after your wife for your debt. They can't go after your children for your debt. So the issue there when someone dies and there's debt is if the estate has some assets, the creditor can get paid from an asset that would be inherited. But other than that, there's a similar kind of issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these are all such good questions, and we appreciate the opportunity to go through these. Because they're very common to a lot of people. We know that people don't always jump out of the woodwork and say to their neighbor, hey, I'm looking at doing a bankruptcy. What do you think about this or that? So anyhow, our next question before our halfway point in the show is about foreclosure. Individual wants to know, can I still file for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy after I've been served with foreclosure documents? And number two on this question, do I have to take the pre-bankruptcy course 6 months before filing or within 6 months before filing the bankruptcy?
Okay, so I'm going to answer those in reverse order. Under what I call the new law, but it's already 10 years old, you can't file a bankruptcy petition without having taken a course through an approved credit counseling agency, which can be done in person, on the telephone, on the internet. Internet is cheap and fast and the easiest way to do it. You get this piece of paper that says you did the counseling, and your lawyer has to have it by your case. So you could have, I tell my clients all the time, we can have all your paperwork done. You could have paid me everything that you're supposed to pay, but if you haven't done the counseling, I can't file your bankruptcy. When does that need to be done? The certificate is good for 6 months. So I generally tell clients that around the time you're paying us for the services, that's when you should do the counseling. I've seen too many situations where clients see me, go and do the counseling right away. It takes them a long time to pay for the attorney's fees, and then the certificate has expired. So the certificate's good for 6 months. But to question number one, the fact that there is already a foreclosure file, the foreclosure is simply a type of a lawsuit. It's a lawsuit that is required to be filed by a mortgage company if they want to take back property. The bankruptcy filing stops the foreclosure. The bankruptcy filing stops any lawsuit that's going on, which are usually a loan or a credit card trying to sue and garnish wages. So the bankruptcy filing, the filing itself, is a very, very powerful means of protection from creditors. It'll stop, besides lawsuits and the foreclosure, a type of lawsuit, it'll stop those nasty cell phone calls and those scary collection letters, and it'll stop a wage garnishment that's going on, even if the IRS has started garnishing. Everything stops with the filing. And with a foreclosure, if someone is looking to save the property, they can use a Chapter 13 and set up a payment plan to pay the past due mortgage and keep their property. If there's a foreclosure on a piece of property that someone doesn't want, they can file a Chapter 7 to eliminate their debt. And in the right situation, you can even do a Chapter 13 to eliminate the mortgage debt.
So many options. You know, Joe, a lot of the times when we talk about different parts of bankruptcy, Chapter 7, Chapter 13, all the different options, all the different things and factors that vary into this bankruptcies, the one thing that we see over and over is that it all depends. The answer to a lot of questions depends on certain specifics in financial matters, but, you know, starting with whether they qualify for a Chapter 7 or they qualify for a Chapter 13 and what that even means. You know, the present, even though you say it's 10 years ago since the new bankruptcy laws have come out, still the present bankruptcy laws are complicated. And all these procedures that we talk about and the documentation that's required for the process can be really overwhelming for people, especially if they're not a bankruptcy lawyer themselves and they're not familiar with the law. When working with Joseph Roble, people should know that he has and his associates over 40 years experience in representing clients in consumer bankruptcies. The experience is what ensures that everybody's individual financial situation will be properly analyzed based on the specific facts and finances. People should know that Joseph Roble and his staff understand that you might be anxious about your financial problems, probably tired of the harassment by the creditors, and might be uncertain as to whether bankruptcy is really what you need to do long term. Well, if bankruptcy will help your financial situation, you'll be properly advised, again, for which chapter you may qualify, 7 or 13, for example. At Joseph Roble Limited, the entire process from beginning to end will be clearly explained, as well as the documents that you will need to provide. So what they'll do is they'll give you this comprehensive what-to-do-next letter at or after your initial free consultation, and it guides you through the entire process from start until finish. If you do not need to file for bankruptcy and use that as protection, they'll tell you. Joseph Roble Limited really is not going to put you into a bankruptcy simply to earn a fee. Joseph Roble Limited is a small law firm of attorneys and staff experienced in consumer bankruptcy. It's not a large bankruptcy law factory, and no one will get lost in the office. However, you will be treated as a human being with the courtesy and dignity and respect you deserve. The overall mission there at Joseph Roble Limited is to have you take control over your finances through the proper use of these bankruptcy laws. Joseph Roble Limited has offices conveniently located in the Chicago Loop and the suburbs, located in Chicago, Chicago's Belmont-Cragen neighborhood, and also in the suburbs of Burr Ridge, Deerfield, Gurnee, Naperville, Orland Park, Schaumburg, Skokie, St. Charles, and Westchester. So they can represent Illinois clients in the Cook County area and all the collar counties of Will, DuPage, Kane, LaSalle, Kendall, and Lake. All right, back to our program. We are on to our next question, which is someone who wants to file for Chapter 7, but they're not working right now, and neither is the spouse. It says, we have a 20-year-old daughter who lives with us, and she works. Is my daughter's income going to be included in the Chapter 7? It says, my wife co-signed on a student loan, but that's the really only attachment to their debts. So what happens here where a daughter's living there and she's the only one working?
So this particular party has done some research into what's known as the median income test, also known as the means test, which is one of the requirements to do a Chapter 7. And the median income test looks at the income for the family, the husband, the wife, or both, for the last 6 months, multiplies it by two, and compares it to the median for the county in which they live, the median income, and their household size. If you're below the median, you've passed the test, and you can look at other issues concerning Chapter 7. So in this particular case, unless there's some other income that they have had other than Social Security, which is exempt, with both husband and wife not employed, there's almost no doubt that the median test is a non-issue. They're going to pass. The question about the daughter's income, would it be included if the daughter gives the parents money for rent or for just contribution to the household or pays family expenses, then that money that the daughter pays is factored into the median income test. But with both of them not working, I don't see how the daughter could possibly be contributing sufficient money so they wouldn't pass the test. The bankruptcy itself would not affect the daughter other than the fact that the daughter's credit report can show that on the student loan that the mother co-signed, that there was a bankruptcy filed, but student loans aren't dischargeable anyway. So that was a long answer. The short answer is the daughter's income, other than what she pays in to the household, if any, doesn't make much difference, and a bankruptcy by the parents shouldn't have no effect on the daughter at all.
There you go. Now, this question and answer also presumes another question and leads into our next question, because where we're talking about filing for Chapter 7 and needing to qualify through the means test, if someone does not qualify for Chapter 7, the other option is the Chapter 13. We've talked a lot about Chapter 13 in our program. There's information on the differences of Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 on ChicagoBankruptcy.com under the blog section. There's questions and answers. It's really a good library of information there. It's worth some time to poke around. There's some videos, all sorts of good explanations there. So our next question that covers Chapter 13, a person wants to know, is there a limit to the amount a creditor can charge in interest and fees over the course of a Chapter 13 on a portion of credit card debt that's declared non-dischargeable? It says, are they reduced to a statutory maximum, or is the creditor allowed to charge whatever rate there was when the case was filed? On the same line with this credit card interest, what happens to student loan interest and fees over bankruptcy term? So again, with the Chapter 13, we've got credit card interest and fees and bankruptcy interest and fees. What are the limits, if any? How does that all work?
All right, so this particular person has done some reading, but has not picked up on some of the nuances. When you file a Chapter 13, credit card interest stops. It does not accrue during the life of the plan, whether the plan is 2, 3, 4, or 5 years. So whatever is owed to any particular credit card on the date of filing, that is what will be repaid over the life of the plan. It may be repaid at less than 100 cents on the dollar if the particular debtor qualifies. There is interest added in to the money that the debtor pays that covers the administrative costs of the trustee. So in our jurisdiction, the trustees right now are getting about 5%. So when I figure a client's payment plan, generally 5% comes off the top each month for the trustee to run their office, and the rest goes to creditors. But other than that, on the credit cards, the interest stops. Student loans, the interest continues to accrue because it's a non-dischargeable debt. So whether that student loan is being paid directly by the debtor while they're paying a Chapter 13, or whether the student loan is being paid by the Chapter 13 trustee from the monthly payments that the debtor pays in, the interest is going to accrue. And what happens there when the Chapter 13 plan is concluded, if the principal balance of the student loan was being paid through the plan, there's going to be some money owed for accrued interest during the plan period that the debtor is going to have to deal with directly with the student loan people. Most of the time, most people have student loans that run longer than 5 years, and it's usually, not always, but usually the cheapest way to deal with the student loan is to continue to pay it directly.
Why is that?
Because the if you have a loan, let's say whatever the dollar amount is, it's going to take you 10 years to pay. And if your Chapter 13 is going to run 5 years, and it can't run longer, Chapter 13's only run 5 years. So if you take that loan that you would have to pay off in 10 years, and if you take that dollar amount and put it into a five-year plan, now you're increasing the amount of money that goes to the student loan people. And generally that's becomes unaffordable for many, many people. That's why,
that makes sense.
Yeah, that's why paying it directly yourself while you're Chapter 13 going on is usually the best way to go. And like with so much with bankruptcy law and any law, as you say, it depends. So we can give general statements, but we have to tailor everything specific to the facts of the individual client's case.
Yeah, but I really do learn something new every time we do our show, and it wouldn't have occurred to me to have the credit cards paid separate. It's not intuitive logic necessarily. So, again, that's why we do this. Everyone's learning. It's really great. We have time for one more question here, and this one is about loan affirmations and reaffirmations. Individual says, we filed bankruptcy a couple of years ago, and our lawyer didn't reaffirm the loan. We want to keep the house, and he quit taking messages. The lawyer, I guess, quit taking messages and sent a letter saying he didn't represent us anymore. Okay, so the lawyer discharged from the case. I said, what do we need to do now? We're still paying on the house, but it's ruined our credit worse than what we were showing when the loan was closed. Wait. Ruin the credit worse because it shows that the loan is closed. We can't get another loan because of our credit, even if we did want it to move. So What should they do? Very interesting.
This is sometimes one of the hardest things for clients to understand. These people are talking about a mortgage, and mortgage companies want people who file Chapter 7 to sign a reaffirmation agreement. That agreement says, even though I'm filing bankruptcy, I'm going to continue to pay you. I'm going to make myself liable personally for this mortgage as long as this loan is in effect. A lot of lawyers consider it malpractice for an attorney to have a client sign a reaffirmation agreement on a mortgage. Why? Because the mortgage company must continue to accept payments from the debtor, even though they file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, without any reaffirmation. It's different on a car you have to reaffirm. But on a mortgage, they must take the payments. So why would it be malpractice? Because when you sign a reaffirmation, you're now making yourself personally responsible for this loan. And everybody has good intentions. Everybody wants to keep their house. But what's going to happen in 6 months, a year, 2 years? What if you can't afford the house? What if there's some catastrophe and you need to move? If you signed a reaffirmation agreement and you lose that property to a foreclosure, you can still be liable for the deficiency that's due the mortgage company when the house is sold through the foreclosure because you've signed a reaffirmation agreement that states so. Without the reaffirmation agreement, in the future, if you walk away or the property is sold, you can't be responsible for any personal deficiency. So that's the very strong value to not signing a reaffirmation agreement on a mortgage. The negatives, the particular questioner raised those negatives. You're not going to be able to refinance with the same mortgage company, and you don't get credit on your credit score for the payments that you make. Those two positives are so outweighed by the negatives, which is why it's often considered malpractice for a lawyer to have you sign a reaffirmation agreement. On Avvo, AVVO.com, if you look me up, Joseph Roble, I wrote a short little article about reaffirmations. Oftentimes it's easier to understand this when you read it.
There you go. Now, Joe, we're out of time for this program, but we have a whole bunch of questions left, and we'll do a part two of this program coming up soon. So people should watch for that on the Facebook page, or whether you find this information on the Twitter or LinkedIn or visiting the website. Either way, we put out a ton of good content and information to help answer some of these questions, so people are a little more educated on the whole process when they call. And really, honestly, if the whole thing seems like a foreign language to you and you have absolutely no idea what to make of this, left, right, or sideways, again, because maybe under, you know, financial stress really makes it difficult in life. So that's why we do this show. It's okay. If you don't understand, go ahead and call Joe Roble and the associates. Will explain everything. So, you know, it's okay if it's a little daunting. That's why they're all there. Joe, tell the people at home and listening how they can get a hold of you, and I'll encourage people to jot down and save this information, because you never know when a friend or neighbor is looking for help. They don't always jump out and say, hey, I'm in financial trouble, but it's good to be there as a good friend and ally for people who do go through financial stress, especially times like this after the holidays. Sometimes people just, in the first of the year, realize they're really underwater and want to make a change and get a fresh start. So, Joe, someone wants to get a fresh start or use that automatic stay and stop those bill collectors, how do they get in touch with you?
Easiest way to do so is email my name, Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, Roble, W-R-O-B-E-L, no punctuation in between, at ChicagoBankruptcy.com. The website, ChicagoBankruptcy.com, as you've mentioned, has tons of information. And in our internet age, people are looking, before they do any kind of activity with any type of a vendor, for information about what they're going to be doing. And call 312-781-0996. My receptionist will put you through to me. I'll be very happy to answer questions that you may have.
All right. And, of course, if you have a question that you want to have read on a show, do the same thing and just say, I'm calling with an anonymous question that I'd like to have read on another show. And we can do it that way as well. But at any rate, we really encourage people to get the information because bankruptcy changes over time and everybody's case is different. So just because, you know, Aunt Ethel had a bankruptcy that was like this doesn't mean that yours will be like that. Very complex, totally different, so many different options. And, again, that's why we do the show. Joe, I want to thank you for your time, and we'll be back with another show pretty soon.
Nick, thank you, as always.
All right. Everybody, enjoy the rest of the holidays. And, of course, there are all sorts of articles and blogs out there on how to save money during the holidays. We hope some of you all took advantage of some of those cost-saving measures. And, again, making budgets and planning for January is a thing to do now. So if you're off work this week and trying to spend some time productively, it's probably a good thing to start making budgets and learning what you can do to take control of your finances and have the best future for you and your family. Again, this is the Chicago Bankruptcy Update with Joseph Roble. Again, the telephone number you can reach him is area code 312-781-0996. Thank you all, and have a great week. Bye-bye now.